the UAW really is so exciting because, like, right as this was all happening, I was, like, really stoned on my couch, and I was like, the Teamsters did it, and I had to delete the tweet right away because I mixed up the Teamsters and the UAW.
We're the lowest paid factory, food factory in London, Kentucky, and we need a voice. We just need some representation to help us.
Everyone else was protected but our miners, and, you know, fortunately, we finally were able to get a standard or get a rule in place that, you know, protects our miners as well.
They're not American citizens. They don't have passports. They don't have visas. So they're living on this ship that has essentially a bridge on top of it.
Just so you know, troublemakers, I am not endorsing nor am I sponsored by Acapulco Gold. I'm not here to say whether you should do it or not. But if you do, let me know how it goes.
You're listening to the Labor Radio Podcast, weekly produced by the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. I'm Chris Garlock. On today's show, VW workers in Chattanooga win a historic union vote to join the UAW. Workers file for election in London, Kentucky. Roland Rex Rexha on the Francis Scott Key Bridge incident. Health and safety wins in Washington, D.C., and a profile of labor organizer and activist Jonathan Melrod. This week's featured shows are Work Stoppage, the podcast that only talks about what can be done for the working class. They're here to demolish corporate ladders and chew bubblegum, and they don't even like bubblegum. BCTGM Voices Project, the podcast from the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers Union. America's Workforce Radio, a clear and unfiltered voice for the working people of America. Solidarity Works, a podcast from the United Steelworkers. And the Resolved Labor Podcast, highlighting labor leaders who we definitely should have learned about in school. This podcast is for union activists, history buffs, and any human who just wants to learn something new. That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of your favorite labor podcast. My name is John.
And I'm Lena.
And we are an entirely listener-supported show. Our name is Work Stoppage, so thank you so much if you support us on Patreon. It really does go a long way. All right, well, we should talk about the big story that everybody's been talking about that's been blowing up my Twitter feed and is relevant to about half of the things that I retweet on a daily basis right now. It's VW workers in Chattanooga. So this weekend, we saw history made by newly added UAW members at VW in Chattanooga. For over a century, labor organizers, socialists, and progressives of all stripes have known that unless we organize the South, we'll never be able to unite the working class and fight back against the bosses. But this week, the UAW made a bigger step towards achieving that goal than we've seen in decades. So immediately after winning an epic struggle against the big three U.S. automakers in the stand-up strike, the UAW has been engaged in one of the most historic organizing drives in recent memory, really in my lifetime. But until this week, we've been talking only about potential wins. But finally, on Friday, April 19th, the workers at Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee, made it real, voting in a landslide to join the most exciting union in the country right now. Now, the fighting UAW. And the UAW really is so exciting because, like, right as this was all happening, I was, like, really stoned on my couch, and I was like, the Teamsters did it, and I had to delete the tweet right away because I mixed up the Teamsters and the UAW. And the next morning, I tweeted, I was like, I got real high, and I mixed up the Teamsters and the UAW in a tweet. I will do it again. And then I had a Teamster in my reply who was like, we wish we were the UAW.
That's like, great.
Don't sell yourself short. You have a pretty good union, but yeah, I like the enthusiasm.
Yeah.
When the final tally came in with 84% of workers participating, workers voted 2,628 to 985, which is 73% in favor of the union. Workers.
That's just huge. Like, I think that, like, that alone is worth a headline.
Just oh, yeah.
Because not only did they have a huge amount of turnout, which is something that does happen during elections, you know, that's not uncommon, but that sort of margin is not
massive.
Always seen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's massive.
on top of the fact that this is in the South, where this sort of organizing is much more difficult, and as has been said many times, including just a minute ago by you, that this is historic, that this that this victory came to pass, and came to pass by 73%.
Well, and to see that kind of margin in an election where there were like 3,500 votes cast or whatever is like really astounding, because like, you know, you get like a really small unit of like 12 people, they can do, you know, they can get like 90 whatever percent. But it's like when it's this big, like this is a really resounding result for a unit of that size.
It's also worth noting that I think it's this particular Volkswagen in Chattanooga, this is not the first time that they made an attempt to get a union at the plant. So
technically,
you know,
technically this is the third I think.
Time. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, which is huge. It's massive to say we failed an election. We have to wait the period of time. I think it's like, what, over a year before you can start another drive. Failed it again.
Mm-hmm.
Waited another year. I mean, this is a long time coming, and it couldn't come at a better time. For the momentum of the labor movement and the momentum of the UAW under Sean Fain's leadership. So this is great. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. Well, and it shows like a lot of people get hung up on the idea that like if you don't get your drive or whatever, then it's like over. And it always reminds me of that old Simpsons joke where like Maggie is locked in the bathroom and like Marge or somebody tries to pick the lock with a coat hanger and it doesn't work. And then they're all just like talking and talking about what they're going to do. And Lisa like pops the door open and they're like, how'd you do that? And she's like, the coat hanger. Why does nobody in this family try things more than once? Really funny. Kelsey Smith, a worker in the paint department, said, quote, this election is big. People in high places told us good things can't happen here in Chattanooga. They told us this isn't the time to stand up. This isn't the place. But we did stand up and we won. This is the time. This is the place. Southern workers are ready to stand up and win a better life. End quote.
Hell yeah.
And so, yeah, just as Smith was alluding to, just ahead of the union vote, governors from 6 different southern states, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Texas, issued a joint statement calling on workers to vote no. In it, they said, quote, as governors, we have a responsibility to our constituents to speak up when we see special interests looking to come into our state and threaten our jobs and the values we live by. End quote.
There's so many things in that statement that are just so egregious. The values we live by is very, very patronizing for one, but then also just declaring unions special interests.
It's like they managed to fill out our entire bingo card of like condescending, patronizing things that companies and politicians say and get it down to one sentence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Just a bunch of whiny babies. Cry harder. Cry harder.
Really, do you need a high chair? Do you need a sippy cup?
This is the BCTGM Voices Project. On April 5th, workers at Hearthside Food Solutions, which we'll also be referring to as HFS in this recording, in London, Kentucky, filed for a union election to be represented by BCTGM Local 57. This action follows decades of effort by BCTGM organizers in 3 HFS locations and dozens of violations of federal labor law by this company, formerly known as Consolidated Biscuit Company.
I'm Lisa Gregory, International Representative for the East Central States Region. I've been on staff for about 4 years and with the BCTGM for 11. Fourth generation union girl though. I'm not on the ground here in London to support these folks with Earl Ferris. He's the business agent helping us out here from Local 57.
I'm Letitia Wharton. I'm an oven operator and I've been with Hearthside for 29 years.
Hi, I'm Roxanne Holman. I've been with Hearthside for about 12 years now. I am a machine operator in mixing. I run the rotary.
Okay, so Lisa, you guys are in London, Kentucky. You have just filed for a union election there. Will you just give us the latest on what's going on down there?
Yeah, so, you know, from the beginning, we first kicked this off late February with our very first meeting, and it kind of hit the ground running from there. So we were able to get enough momentum, which is still going, to file for election on April the 5th. And with the new rules under the labor board, everything is moving very quickly. We actually have our hearing tomorrow. to get to an agreement on the details of the election. So the sooner the better, of course. Everybody's anxious and they're excited. They've been in there doing the work. So yeah, we'll have to get to an agreement tomorrow, get the details lined out, hopefully vote as soon as possible. We have a facility of, you know, over 600 people. And the issues are here right now and they're fired up.
Awesome. That's great. Leticia, can you just kind of just give us a few of the reasons why you feel like you're ready for a union down there now?
I feel like we're ready for a union now because we have been treated poorly over the years, and it has gotten worse and worse and worse. They keep taking things from us and never giving back.
Roxanne, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, if you have a voice at our factory, there is the retaliation is unfathomable. And if you stand up against the retaliation, that's it. You're fired. Your job is just out the door. I mean, it's one thing after another. They've taken our 401k match away. There are, I believe, 70 people still waiting on their vacation pay from last year. I mean, it's one thing after another, and people are just fed up.
I wonder if you have anything to add as far as what's keeping you in this fight, because like Lisa said, it's not an easy thing to organize a union. So what is it that makes you stay strong through this?
For me personally, my family works there. You know, my husband and my daughter both work there. I'm trying to make it a better place for them. There's not a lot to choose from in London, Kentucky. I mean, we used to be one of the better paying factories, and now we're the lowest. There's no incentive to keep people going. That's what we're fighting for. It's for the future of that plant. I'm voting yes for the union because everyone in there deserves a voice. I'm fighting for their voices.
I'm voting yes because my husband has worked through the BTCGM union for 23 years. He has better pay. He has better insurance. He has a pension. He also has 401k match. And we have none of that. Like she says, we're the lowest paid food factory in London, Kentucky. And we need a voice and to help us to get to where they're not retaliating against us, where if you bid on a job, they already know who is getting that job before you even bid on it. We just need some representation to help us.
Where does your husband work? Just curious.
Bimbo, London, Kentucky.
Okay, local 57.
Yes.
If you found this content valuable, please consider sharing it on your own social media pages and be sure to tag us. We are BCTGM on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For more on the activities of the BCTGM, go to bctgm.org.
More than 80 years ago, U.S. Labor Secretary Francis Perkins identified silica dust as a deadly hazard and called on employers to fully protect workers. Yet still today, in 2024, workers continue to be exposed to mixed coal mine dust containing respirable crystalline silica. This is why the USW and many other unions over the past decades have fought relentlessly for government agencies, including the Mine Safety and Health Administration, also known as MSHA, to limit the amount of exposure workers face on the job. Finally, this past April 16th, MSHA, through the Department of Labor, issued a final rule reducing silica dust exposure to better protect America's miners.
Welcome to Solidarity Works, a podcast from the United Steelworkers Union. I'm Chelsea Engel, proud member of the United Steelworkers.
Another major agency in Washington, known as MSHA, or the Mine Safety and Health Administration, also released another rule to protect workers this month on April 16th that the USW and other unions have been fighting for, like the walk-around rule, for decades. Tom Duffy, who also works in the union's Health, Safety, and Environment Department, knows just how vital it is for agencies like MSHA to look out for workers. Before he came to the USWS staff, he worked in steel mills in the Pittsburgh area and served as a safety coordinator.
Well, to me, health and safety and many of the other jobs that I had prior to becoming union, I seen a lot of locations, I've seen a lot of bad companies that really didn't work or didn't look out for worker health and safety. I've seen a lot of exposures to chemicals, asbestos.
Tom says that MSHA in particular is the frontline agency that is designed to protect miners, which is something our nation's history has shown has not always been a priority.
Miners weren't treated well, you know. Coal and other mining resources were always more important than the workers' health and safety. And a lot of workers died early on. There was a lot of, coal diseases, black lung. We know now that silica played a big part in why a lot of our miners were sick and unfortunately passed at young ages. So, MSHA was really important because whenever MSHA was formed, you know, there was protections for workers, similar to what OSHA does today.
The rule that MSHA just implemented this month focuses specifically on exposure to respirable crystalline silica, an incredibly harmful dust that, when inhaled in large quantities, can cause chronic, fatal diseases, including silicosis, which leads to cancer. What makes it especially damaging is its size. Silica dust is 100 times smaller than a grain of sand. You can breathe it in without even knowing.
It's a very toxic chemical, you know, and, you know, it's something that miners are exposed to when you break or crush rock. You know, there's a lot of newer technology now where machinery has gotten more powerful. They have to dig deeper and farther to get to whatever it is, the mineral that is that they're trying to mine nowadays. And it's gotten a lot more toxic, and we're seeing a lot of workers that are a lot younger that are starting to develop serious chronic illnesses in their workplace. Before the new rule came out, that actually came out, and we had an event yesterday for, you know, workers, the PEL for worker exposure under MSHA was 100 micrograms per cubic meter of air, where in 2016, OSHA changed the PEL to 50 micrograms per cubic meter. So, you know, everyone else was protected but our miners. And, you know, fortunately, we finally were able to get a standard or get a rule in place that, you know, protects our miners as well, just like they're protecting everyone else.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first.
Let's go to line number two, and welcome to the show, Roland Rexa, better known as Rex, and he's speaking on behalf of the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, and this is the segment we do each and every month on behalf of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. For complete updates, TTD transportation.org. And this is a collection of over three dozen unions that deal with transportation, whether it's on land, on the sea, rail, or on the air. Doesn't really matter. Roland, welcome to America's Workforce. I know you're here today to talk about what happened in Baltimore with the collapse of that bridge. And I'm replaying in my mind all the time when I saw that carrier come through there and hit it. And all of a sudden it was like falling apart. And obviously that has had quite an effect on shipments and deliveries going out and coming in. What is the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association? What's the role of MEBA in all of this right now, Rex?
Well, we're the largest American flag. We represent officers on the American flag, so American ships. Now, here's the thing. The ship that hit that bridge is a foreign flag ship. And I think where we see there should be some changes and where we see that, hey, there's potential problems that of what happened here. And we'll see what happens when the NTSB does their full report. But we believe that there was some issues when it came down to how the workers on these ships, which are foreign workers, how they're treated, how they're what resources they're given. And it could have led to some of the issues and potentially led to this disaster.
Were you surprised that it came down like it did when you saw that video?
It's pretty crazy. You see something like that I see my kids playing with toys all the time, and you see a bridge like that or something go down, and you're like, okay. But you see it on such a massive scale, you worry. You worry about, you know, our infrastructure. Is this something that could happen in other places? And what safety procedures are put in place to protect other places? Like, God forbid something like this happens again.
I'm just wondering, what's the status of those on the ship right now? Because I know a big chunk of the bridge fell on top of it, and they were like stationary. I don't know where we are right now, but maybe you can explain that to our listeners. What's the status of that?
So they're required to stay on the ship. They're not American citizens. They don't have passports. They don't have visas. So they're living on this ship that has essentially a bridge on top of it. There's 22 mariners on there. There's people providing aid to them and giving them resources, but they're stuck on the ship until either the ship can move or they find some other way to remove them.
So in your estimation, how long will that take? I mean, how long are they going to be on that ship?
I think my gut tells me it'll be at least another month or so. I think once they remove the bridge off and they're able to float the vessel up, I think that's then they'll be able to start. They'll be able to get them out of there.
Oh, that's amazing. Roland Rexa, better known as Rex, Secretary Treasurer of MEBA, which is the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, been around since 1875. Rex, thank you so much for joining us. Please keep in touch with us, okay?
Yeah, thanks. And anytime you need me talk about maritime, I'm more than happy.
Hello, troublemakers. Welcome to this week's episode of Resolved Labor Podcast. This week, we will be highlighting Jonathan Mailrod. Jonathan Mailrod was born June 10th, 1950. Shout out to the Geminis. He was born to Leonard and Miriam Mailrod, who were both from Newark, New Jersey. Leonard was a shoe salesman who became a self-taught attorney. He didn't have money for tuition, so he convinced the students at the university to open the window above the door so he could hear the professor's lectures and take notes. And as a testament to his resolve, Leonard met and married a woman many agreed was out of his league, Miriam. When Jonathan was six, the family moved to a large Jewish middle-class neighborhood on the northwest quadrant of D.C. By all accounts, life was simple and safe for John. He would ride his bike and play basketball at the community center where his dad was the coach. John had his first bout with anti-Semitism when his mother sent a note to his teacher stating that John, then in the second or third grade, said that he wasn't allowed to rehearse Christmas songs with the class because of their Jewish heritage. Jonathan remembers the teacher going ham and yelling, you know, Mr. Mailrod, I understand you won't be with the rest of the class when we share holiday with the elderly. Then she made him drag his wooden desk out into the hallway so that the rest of the students could gawk at him. When John was 10 or 11, he witnessed whites pour bleach into the community pool when blacks tried to have it desegregated. He says it was then that he realized that some white people felt, quote, disdain and challenged by blacks, even if they were kids. At the age of 14, John was sent to Putney Boarding School in Vermont. The Putney School is an independent progressive high school that was formed in 1935. It's a boarding school, but it also has a day student component. John remembers the other students were sophisticated and artsy and well-versed in all things politics. He stood out and remembers thinking, why did my parents send me to a school on a farm? But John soon adopted a new and exciting vision of how his generation could create a new world built on compassion and humanity. Same, John. Same. He read about revolutions breaking out in Latin America and Africa. He and his friends grew their hair long, wore, you know, bright colored bell bottoms, and of course they smoked gold colored weed called Acapulco Gold. So, troublemakers, Acapulco Gold is a strand of cannabis, the weed, that was popular during the 1960s counterculture movement for its potency and, you know, unique color. It was first recorded in the United States in 1964, and it was described by the Oxford English Dictionary as a, quote, special grade of cannabis growing in the vicinity of Acapulco with a color of brownish gold or a mixture of gold and green, end quote. It was called the connoisseur pot in the 1960s. It was sought after marijuana for American smokers, and it was considered better quality than the weed growing in California or Texas. So John became caught up in the political and cultural revolution of the 60s. He and his friends, they vehemently, you know, opposed the Vietnam War and, you know, avidly supported the civil rights movement. After graduation, John headed to University of Wisconsin-Madison, that he describes as, you know, a hotbed of youthful countercultural rebellion. In his first week, he enthusiastically embraced Students for Democratic Society. At the time, it was a nationwide organization with tens of thousands of members on 300 campuses. Hell yes.
And that'll do it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Just a small sample of the amazing programs aired over the last week on more than 200 labor radio and podcast shows. They're all part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows, laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This podcast is recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement. The Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited this week by Patrick Dixon. I produce the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Mr. Harold Phillips. For the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garluck urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show.